Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove, Executive Director here at the Lowy Institute for International Policy, and it's my pleasure to be welcoming you to today's address by the Chief of Navy, Vice Admiral Tim Barrett. Welcome back to Sydney, Admiral. The Royal Australian Navy has had a presence here in Port Jackson for more than two centuries, if you take into account its relationship with the Royal Navy. I'm pleased to say the Navy has ably and swiftly dispatched any challenges to its place in Sydney, any efforts to get it to relocate, including one of the more recent challenges, which was made in this very room by Prime Minister Rudd during the last election campaign. But we're delighted to hear that and to see you every day as we walk around town to know that the Navy's still with us in Sydney. It's a really important part of our identity as a city. The naval tradition, of course, is an important part of our nation's worldview. We learned our strategic policy at the knee of the largest empire in history and the world's largest naval power. And so when people ask me, why does Australia think it has global interests? Why doesn't it just focus on its immediate surrounds? I think it makes sense when you think about the history and you realise that we first learned our role in the world in conjunction with the Royal Navy and the British Empire. And certainly when you go to the War Memorial in Canberra and you look at all those theatres in which Australians have served, from China in the Boxer Rebellion to the Sudan to Sinai and Palestine and not to mention areas much closer to home, it's pretty obvious that wired into our DNA is a view that although Asia is our strategic home, there's no question that we see ourselves as a country that has an interest, a stake in the global balance of power, that when the global balance of power favours Western values, that benefits Australia. And I think that will be an enduring element of our worldview. As an island continent, of course, we have unique strengths, but also challenges in protecting our sovereignty. We don't share a land border with a neighbour, and that offers a natural defence. But it also means that our first line of defence lies offshore. And the senior service, the Royal Australian Navy, has always played a vital role protecting Australia both near and far. But of course, as the strategic environment changes, so too does the role of the Navy. And we see very clearly that there are global changes afoot, that wealth and power are moving eastwards towards us, that we are becoming less isolated from the world, but also less insulated from it, that we are closer to the emerging markets. And that's an exhilarating element of our location. But we're also closer to crises and tensions and troubles that will probably be crucial to the future of international peace and security. And in that context, we need the Navy more than we ever have before. So it's timely to discuss the interconnected nature of naval power in the 21st century and how that provides greater military weight to the Australian government in meeting the demands of national security. Let me tell you how today will work, and then I'll introduce the Admiral. We'll hear from the Chief of Navy, and then my colleague, Dr. Ewan Graham, our International Security Director, will conduct a question and answer session. Ladies and gentlemen, Vice Admiral Tim Barrett, CSCAO, joined the Royal Australian Navy in 1976. He served on a number of Her Majesty's Australian ships, including Melbourne, Perth, Brisbane, Stalwart, Adelaide, and Canberra. His staff appointments have included Deputy Director, Air Warfare Development, Director, Naval Officers Postings, and Director General of Defence Force Recruiting. He's also held a number of command positions, including as Commanding Officer, HMAS Albatross, Commander, Border Protection Command, and most recently as Commander of the Australian Fleet. In 2006, he received a Conspicuous Service Cross for his achievements in naval aviation. And we were just talking about the wonderful Fleet Air Arm Museum in Nowra. If anybody goes to the South Coast for their summer holidays, I urge you to go to that museum because it's got a wonderful collection of Australian naval history there. In 2009, the Admiral became a member of the Order of Australia. He was made an Officer of the Order of Australia in 2014 for his leadership of Border Protection Command and the Australian Fleet. Vice Admiral Barrett holds a Bachelor of Arts in Politics and History and a Master of Defence Studies, both from the University of New South Wales. He recently completed the Advanced Management Program at Harvard Business School. Vice Admiral Barrett assumed command of the Royal Australian Navy on the 1st of July 2014. Ladies and gentlemen, Admiral Barrett. Ladies and gentlemen, firstly, can I say that I did not realise the significance that this is where former Prime Minister Rudd made that statement about Garden Island. I was the fleet commander at the time, and it was a couple of weeks before we embarked on the International Fleet Review in Sydney. As part of that review, it was my role to confirm that all of the facilities ashore were sound, and part of that, I had two tugs on the eastern side of the island, actually straining and pulling on some of the bollards that we had on land to actually confirm that these were suitable for ships that we were going to put there. But as I drove into work and saw this happening, I realised a day after the announcement that the Navy would move to Brisbane, it looked very much like we were trying to tow Garden Island out of Sydney and to further climbs. But that did not occur. Look, I thank you very much for the introduction, for the opportunity to talk here today. Last Friday, I was in Sydney here for the commissioning of HMAS Adelaide, the second of our large amphibious ships. 12 months ago, I was here when Canberra was commissioned. And doing that as a Chief of Navy and seeing the significance of the recapitalisation of where Navy is going caused me over the last 12 months of my tenure here as the Chief of Navy to really ponder over why we had these ships and what we were doing, and to actually draw some sense of where the discussion about where naval doctrine fits into the broader strategic sense of what government should be thinking. So over the past year, I set my mind to talking to a number of audiences about why. I have spoken to audiences in the US and also in the UK mid-year, and so I'm delighted with the opportunity to round out that in my own country, my own nation here, partly with the view that it was done overseas so that the only question, and I'm preempting here, that the only question that wouldn't be asked of me is how many submarines and where they're going to be built. So let me just please give you my thoughts. Now, the defence of the nation, and together with the provision of physical, economic and social security of the citizens of that nation, are the central planks that support the legitimacy, the credibility, authority of any government. They're also at the heart of the contract between the people and their government. And we in Australia have been blessed. Since Federation, our governments have honoured this contract with varying degrees of success, it must be said, as they have balanced the myriad of fiscal, social and political pressures that distinguish modern democracies. The Great Depression, which had such a terrible impact on the lives of so many Australians, led to an underinvestment in national defence capability in the years immediately before World War II. But the same cannot be said for the years leading up to World War I, as the newly formed Commonwealth government grappled with political volatility, the challenges of integrating federal administrative systems, and the monumental task of creating a national identity. If Admiral William Creswell is considered the father of the Royal Australian Navy, I think we agree he is, or was, Alfred Deakin, our second Prime Minister, was its principal architect. It was Deakin who gave an early expression to the political philosophy that continues to provide the fundamental raison d'etre of the national defence enterprise. Defence, said Deakin, is the ultimate guardian of liberty, the freedom granted in the rule of law that flows from the recognition that each citizen has dignity and value. And, in Deakin's view, any attack on that dignity is an attack on the nation as a whole. Now, while I'm generally reluctant to recite lengthy quotes from authorities, I think it is important to understand Deakin's articulation of the policy underpinnings of the National Defence Enterprise that were as true when he spoke in 1907 as they are today. And this is what he said to the House of Representatives on Friday, the 13th of December in 1907, an ominous day, Friday the 13th, but this is what he said.
If we lost the whole of our financial possessions, we should miss them much less than if we were robbed of liberty, constitutional freedom, civilization, and social status. One hesitates even to consider such prospects, and yet one must recollect that there are grave contingencies to be kept in view if it be only at the back of our minds. None of us can conceive Australians in serfdom or subject to an alien rule. Although the incredible consequences that would follow from the obliteration of our race and nationality cannot be compassed by the imagination, we can never forget that what we have most to defend, first and last, is our national life and ideals, more precious than life of the breathing frame. And I think this is great oratory, but he continued, "What we seek is not the development of what is sometimes termed a military as distinguished from a martial spirit. What we aim is the maximum of good citizenship, with a spirit of patriotism as the chief motive power of a civic defence force. For always, behind the weapons, behind the organisation, behind the gun, there is a man. It is in the character and capacity of its manhood that the real strength and energy of resistance of a people must be found." Now let's accept that such muscular phrases may sound chauvinistic in today's world. But there is no challenging the import of Deakin's words. The moral quality of the people is the rock on which national defence stands. As he proceeded with that speech to Parliament in 1907, he outlined his vision for the Royal Australian Navy, referring to Australia's need for maximum of navalism. It is a vision that continues to inspire our modern Navy. Deakin further emphasised that the sea was the first line of defence and we in Australia were reliant upon it. He said, "Ours is an island continent and its best defence will be that which prevents an invader from ever setting foot upon our shores." Deakin was, of course, providing a contemporary answer to that age-old question, is there anything for which a nation has the right to spill the blood of its children? Now, those of us who might have paid attention at Sunday school would remember that this was the question that confronted Abraham when God demanded the sacrifice of Isaac. And as Genesis 22 tells the story, God let Abraham off the hook because he was obedient and had faith. He had shown his fear of God, for which he was willing to sacrifice his only son. These days, I ask, would God personally intervene and put the same question to any one of us? But the thing that does justify the expenditure of blood and treasure in our democratic society is our regard for any attempt to constrain the personal liberty of our citizens, because it is that which defines us as citizens. Deakin got it. He also understands implicitly that there is a community that shares these values. While in 1907, that community, from an Australian perspective, was the British Empire. In present-day terms, it is the community of democratic nations that place the individual liberty of our citizens, expressed in the rather formal phrase, the rule of law, at the centre of their political values. These values, I might note, inspired the overwhelming support of democratic nations for the United States as it confronted the horror of 9/11, and what drove Prime Minister Howard to evoke ANZUS in support of the US for the first time in the treaty's history. So how do these values translate to my business as the armed service of the government? Well, war, it is said, is always a continuation of policy by other means. The policy in question, of course, is the policy of domination, the policy of expansion of national power, the policy of enslavement of other peoples, and the policy of expropriation of their national treasure. And the means to achieve that, of course, is armed force. The great theorist of war, Clausewitz, postulated that defence is the stronger form of war. His argument is that when a nation is under attack, it has the united political, moral, emotional, and economic strength of the citizens to act to protect the freedom of the people. Clausewitz was right. But his argument has an interesting consequence. Because defence is the stronger form of war, it must remain at the forefront of national policy if it is to provide the constant reassurance that democratic peoples demand if they are to go about their ordinary occupations and build both national strength and national resilience. Now, the world community of nations is constantly changing. And while we might all search for constancy, order, and predictability, the fact is there is an intrinsic randomness at play in world affairs. There is ambiguity in global political affairs, and discontinuity and unpredictability characterize the strategic environment in which governments create their defense policies. Now, most of us prefer simplicity and clarity. Yet the curious fact is that ambiguity and discontinuity actually provide us with critically important opportunities that go to the heart of strategic policy making. You see, war is a fundamentally human activity. People make war. So those of us who understand the inherent strength of a defensive strategy also understand that warmongers also prefer simplicity and clarity. And that is where they are most vulnerable, because we can exploit that preference by maximizing their uncertainty. We do that by leveraging ambiguity and discontinuity for our own strategic ends. We play with the minds of our adversaries. That, fundamentally, is how we go from values to war. Central to Australia's naval strategy is the Royal Australian Navy's ability to conduct both defensive and offensive operations in delivering defence policy for the government of the day. I noted earlier that defence is the stronger form of war. For the nation's defensive systems to have effect, however, we need to be able to force an adversary to pause and reflect. We need to be able to create uncertainty in the adversary's mind. We do this by being able to sanction errors of decision and judgment through the use of offensive lethal force, where the consequences of error are seen in the destruction of the adversary's operating systems. And while we always seek to leverage the ambiguity of our force disposition by forcing the adversary to ask, where the hell is he? Or will he or won't he? The fact is that we must be able to deliver lethal force if the adversary makes the wrong choice. I've said this before, and it's precisely what I mean by decisive lethality. Lethality that both sanctions a wrong decision and forces the decision maker to step back. Whether that decision to step back is the result of deterrence or of applied lethality makes little difference. It is the ability to act offensively that actually makes the difference. The best form of defence is a good offence. Some defence planners view defence and offence as the end of a spectrum where defensive capabilities are slowly cranked up and supplemented to deliver lethal force. But I don't see it that way at all. Our Navy is a system where all the elements are mutually and systematically reinforcing. It is a system that delivers a critical effect, defeating the adversary through the application of decisive lethality. For that reason, I see defence and offence as planning and operating dimensions within which the entire system delivers the government's strategic intention. What this means is that decisive lethality is central to the strategic posture of the Royal Australian Navy. Now, the corollary of this is that without the ability to deliver lethal force that determines strategic decision-making, a Navy can be little more than a border protection force or a Coast Guard. While modern navies have plenty of ambition, the fact is that none of them can single-handedly maintain ubiquitous sea control. The best that a modern Navy can do on its own is to deny the adversary the ability to operate in specific areas. And that denial is delivered by means of decisive lethality. As I said earlier, Strategic offensive capabilities are central to the nation's ability to wage war, and those capabilities provide the lethality that is so central in war to both deterrence and to prevailing in the contest of minds. But while the Royal Australian Navy can deliver decisive lethality, it is, like all comparable navies, unable to do so in every possible operational circumstance. Good targeting and the premeditated use of ambiguity and deception serve to maximise uncertainty in the mind of the adversary. The fact is, however, that the forces that deliver lethality cannot be everywhere at all times, and the adversary is able to break free. To complicate the adversary's decision space, those exercising strategic command need to generate distributed lethality, as the US planners so call it. And that is done through alliances and coalitions. If decisive lethality is the fulcrum of war, distributed lethality is the panoply of war, to use the expression of the 19th century US politician and constitutionalist William Whiting. And this brings me to the central concept of interdependence. The community of Western nations emerged from the Cold War with a sense of strategic vindication and a strong sense of relief. Our governments immediately began harvesting the peace dividend, channeling spending away from defence and international social and physical infrastructure. The focus of strategic planning moved from collective defence to that of national defence. Alliances, of course, stayed in place, but unwieldy treaties such as CETO and CENTO have already fallen into abeyance. We all hoped we would never again need to prepare for all-out war, but here again, hope triumphed over experience. Through the 90s, we saw a number of peacekeeping operations in Kuwait, Angola, Cambodia, Somalia, Rwanda, the Balkans and East Timor, just to name a few. These operations demonstrated yet again that the prevention of war, the enforcement of the peace, and the maintenance of stability are cooperative endeavours. And as I mentioned, 9/11 saw the community of liberal democracies come together in ways that were never expected. In the 21st century, the world community faces international terrorism on a scale that was unimaginable in the 20th century. The long engagements in Iraq and Afghanistan have seen the liberal democracies come together in coalitions that are focused as much on national security as they are on global security, even the return of stability in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the defeat of terrorist groups. For Australia, our traditional alliances have strengthened in the last decade. Our long-standing relationships with the UK, the US and New Zealand have provided the springboard for our cooperation with NATO partners. And in Asia, our relationships with Malaysia and Singapore, along with the Asian partners of the US, that is Korea, Japan, Thailand and the Philippines, have diversified and strengthened in ways that were inconceivable a decade or so ago. We are increasingly aware of the interdependence that is central to the ability of modern states to manage their broader regional and global security interests. The emergence of new state players, changing strategic balances, and the shifting kaleidoscope of interests and aspirations is creating a multidimensional strategic environment where new forms of partnership and cooperation emerge to address the protection and promotion of common interests. Whereas alliances are relationships with lock-in, these emerging partnerships and coalitions are flexible, adjusting quickly both to problems but also to the inevitable opportunities. But from the viewpoint of warfighting, alliances and partnerships are the sine qua non of distributed lethality. They are the essential precondition for transcending the limits of decisive lethality driven by national capability to enable distributed lethality driven by common purpose. Now, strategic commentary abounds with myths, we know that. Many of them reflect in my view, a naive linearity of thinking, while others indicate an inability on the part of the commentators to understand the systemic nature of both strategic policy and force posture. Self-reliance and interdependence do not actually sit at opposite ends of some sort of polar spectrum, locked in both competition and opposition. Nations spend their money on military systems to meet national objectives, and Australia is no exception. Our force posture is constructed to meet the specific strategic objectives ordained by government. Indeed, if our force posture were not so constructed, we would have a defence capability that consists of little more than a mishmash, an untidy kit bag of tools lacking purpose, focus, and meaning. It is precisely the coherence of our force posture, designed as it is to meet the imperatives of our national strategic goals, that enables Australia to contribute and benefit from this strategic interdependence. Strategically, as we know, or strategy, as we know, is ultimately about ends and means. And where ends, that is, the strategic goals, are shared, means enable the cooperation that is increasingly the engine for waging war. And just as self-reliance and interdependence do not exist as polar opposites, nor do ends and means. They are dynamic coefficients that mutually condition each other in decision-making. But this has quite a fascinating consequence. Interdependence is as much an end in conceiving strategic success as it is a means for delivering it. It is this that is intrinsic to sound strategy. And by virtue of its history, its tradition, its doctrine, and its culture, the Royal Australian Navy is well positioned for the demands of joint and combined operations with allies and with its partners. Cooperation and interoperability are, as it were, in our DNA as a service. Because the Royal Australian Navy operates in a global, interconnected environment, the alliances and partnerships are what deliver the distributed lethality that reinforces the strategic effectiveness of our decisive lethality. I might argue, as Chief of Navy, that my workload would be much less if the Navy were designed and structured to meet the more limited purposes of an exclusively national policy. A go-it-alone Navy might be considerably easier to command, not least of all because no consideration would need to be paid to the interests and ability of others. But a go-it-alone Navy would be useless. It would be a national albatross rather than a national asset. Central to my responsibilities as the RAN capability manager is the need to ensure that the Navy can interact with like-minded navies at the policy, planning, and capability levels. This is no simple task, but it is one that the ADF is actually quite good at, but there is always room for improvement. It might seem slightly odd to some that relationship management would rank so high on the priorities of someone responsible for ensuring that the Navy can fight and win at sea. The development of trust and confidence, however, goes to the heart of the ability to deploy distributed lethality, to the heart of the ability to deny the maritime spaces to a would-be adversary. We often talk of this in terms of interoperability, the capacity to achieve similar goals employing similar capabilities. If only it was so simple. Modern military relationships focus as much on policy and doctrine as they do on operational techniques and tactical manoeuvre. While integrated command, control, communications, and intelligence systems are the holy grail for many planners, their effect depends on the clarity of leadership intentions and the compatibility of doctrine, the principles upon which the Navy operates as a warfighting system. As Clausewitz famously noted, war is foggy. In a world where fuzzy logic is actually helping us to limit the consequences of uncertainty, it is hardly surprising that fixed systems, rigid thinking, inflexible rules and uniform procedures do not drive interoperability in contemporary or prospective circumstances. But where interoperability is based on the clarity of the goal and shared attachment to a common purpose, diversity in capabilities is no longer a showstopper. Indeed, capability diversity may well provide the additional force flexibility that takes playing with the adversary's mind, indeed, to new heights. So the strategic challenges facing modern governments are enormous. The apparent chaotic nature of power shifts, related as they are to economic cycles, the forces of nationalism and ideology, the quality of international leaders, and the resilience of communities impose extraordinary burdens on national leaders. In microcosm, the recent Greek debt crisis illustrates how uncertainty can work to threaten the destruction of a national economy and the destabilization of the entire economy of Europe. Yet leaders recognize the need to support interdependence. If, in times of crisis, interdependence is so important, how much more important can it be in times of opportunity? And despite all the problems the international community is currently facing, there is still enormous opportunity. Interdependence affords both leaders and planners a significant asset in the long-term enhancement of national, regional, and global security, so long as they use it as a multiplier of national strategic capacity. In 1907, Alfred Deakin saw interdependence in terms of Australia's place in the empire and its particular relationship with Britain. Yet he recognised interdependence for what it was, a fundamental strategic asset for those nations that put the value and dignity of their citizens at the centre of their national political, economic, and strategic enterprise. I suspect he would applaud those of his successors who have held a similar view and who have worked to deliver the range of alliances and partnerships that, for Australia, define our strategic interdependence at the same time as securing our strategic independence. Because he would have said, independence and interdependence are two sides of the same strategic coin. Ladies and gentlemen, in my view, it is important that from time to time, the people who are privileged to command your Navy re-express traditional naval doctrine in contemporary language, addressing contemporary issues. This is even more important as we head into a period of significant strategic change, to which the Australian government is indeed responding with the largest reinvestment in our national capability, naval capability, since Deakin. While I aim to leave a useful legacy to my successors, I hope that today's presentation inspires all of you with an even greater sense of confidence that Australia is well positioned for the naval challenges of the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Admiral Bennett. If I could ask you just to remain at the podium. We're very glad that you've dispelled some of the fogs of strategy and picked the Lowy Institute for your return home at the end of this important series of speeches. As a Chief of Navy, to dispel the fog of strategy by invoking Clausewitz, I particularly congratulate you, having not mentioned Mahan or Corbett once. What better faith, vote of faith could there be in a joint force than that? I would like to get the ball rolling on questions just by asking one question, and then I will open it to the floor. Vice Admiral Barrett has kindly agreed to be with us until 1 o'clock. You mentioned that warmongers prefer clarity and simplicity. It strikes me that we also live in a world now that's moving to a more complex series of challenges where those who are asking questions of the Western order, as it has been generally understood, are actually using ambiguity in a calculated way, whether it's in the South China Sea or the East China Sea, Ukraine or Crimea. in a way that makes it much harder to determine at what point the threshold of force and which militaries become involved. I just would welcome your thoughts on how successful you think we have been generally in the West, and if you'd care to relate that particularly to how the Royal Australian Navy grapples with that particular challenge.
I think you've hit a very important point. The move away from what we might have considered to be a traditional thinking is challenging every Western defence force at this stage. I think in part it is for us to consider our own agility in how we can manage how they seek to do this, how they seek to create ambiguity in our mind, if you want, with a view of being inside their decision loop, if I can say that, to repeat the same to them. The point of what I've been saying here to some extent also is that we need to move to new thinking if we're going to tackle not just our traditional view of how a Navy might operate, but the nature of how others are operating against us. Now, this sounds like a common sense view, but the reality is it's what we are seeing right now, and it's the very point about driving a level of agility, a level of thinking of a systemic approach, or a systematic approach, I should say, that is likely, in my view, to drive success against those that would seek to do the same against us. It's not vulnerabilities of individual weapons and individual platforms. It's about your systematic approach, which includes flexibility and agility that drives your response to those who would seek to do the same against them.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, the floor is open for questions. We have some microphones. Can I please ask you to identify yourself and to keep your question short and to the point, please? Questions for the Admiral.
Thank you. My name is Marford Angeles. I'm from the Philippine Consulate. And, of course, my question is about the South China Sea and how the Royal Australian Navy sees the how it will play out in the next 5 or 10 years.
Well, clearly there have been some changes in the South China Sea in the last 5 to 10 years. The role of our Navy, clearly, is to enforce government policy and directive. The Australian government's view at the moment is, or its position at the moment, is that those that would seek to claim particular areas or particular roles within that area should do so through international fora, through the appropriate measures that constitute rule of law, which is fundamentally what Australia seeks to do in its global context. It makes no claim about individual nations that seek to do that, but applies its view to every nation that might seek to do that. The role that I foresee for Navy will be to enact the Australian government's view over the next 2 to 4 to 10 years in being able to enforce that from a global perspective. We have had ships ply those waters for decades. We still send ships to that area, and we did this year through those waters to demonstrate the Australian government's commitment to accepting whomever is operating in those areas that is done so through the rule of law.
Thank you. Question here at the front.
Commodore Richard Pell, I'm the UK Defence Advisor. Sir, thank you for those fascinating words, and I couldn't help reflect as you spoke on comparing with the UK's recently published Strategic Defence and Security Review, many of which the themes mirror what your points you made there, particularly in delivering decisive lethality, and you recognise the new capabilities the UK is buying, but also more the second priority of the UK, which is global alliances and forming long-term relationships. And I think this is clearly going to be something in the future. We focus in the review very much on Five Eyes communities and other global institutions. There's the ASP blog last week, there was comment made about strategic partnerships and the potential for Australia, and a comment by Graham Dunk. How do you see the future of strategic partnerships? Where do you see that going? What are the opportunities there?
I think what I've indicated today is we've had a long-standing alliance with the US
And that stands. And that has been something reinforced through previous white papers. And we'll see how that is discussed during the next white paper when it is released early next year. But I think it's also important to note that we have, as I mentioned, we have increased our level of engagement with our regional partners, those in Asia in particular, through bilateral arrangements, which are affected from Navy's perspective quite clearly through engagement and through exercise and through exchanges on a regular basis. I see that increasing. I see our Navy enacting government policy even more so in the region through those successful methods, because navalism has always had that ability to enact policy through those means. So I don't see a change to our current strong relationship with the US. I see it to be not mirrored, but supplemented by an increasing level of cooperation through some of our regional partners. We've already done that, as I said, with the Philippines, with Japan, with Vietnam, and with others. We are engaging more so in the region than I would suggest we did 15 or 20 years ago.
Admiral Barrett, could I go to a slightly more granular level and invite you to reflect on the recent fleet concentration exercises that the RAN has performed, which, for the benefit of those in the audience who are not aware, is, in a sense, a throwback to operating together as a large task group.
Yes.
In the way that the RAN hasn't done for several years. But to connect it back to your address, I was struck that you mentioned that perhaps the best that could be hoped now is to deny an area of sea that there are particular challenges in terms of sea control. Sea control obviously would be key, I would have thought, to the whole concept of fleet concentration. So would care for your thoughts on that.
The principal aim of the recent fleet concentration period, held off the East Coast over the last couple of weeks, was a reinvigoration of naval tactical doctrine to demonstrate how we need to work as a system within a task group construct. It is the basis for how navies around the world are now operating, moving away from single ships operating in isolated areas. And as we discussed earlier, in a previous question, in fact your first question, the fact that you now work as a system as opposed to an individual is a way of offering both difficulty for an adversary to understand how and why, but also strength in how you operate that ambiguity when you're talking to or when you're engaged with an adversary. But I mentioned that when I started, we have introduced two new LHDs over the last 12 months. They will form a significant part of where this Navy will go into the future, not just for amphibious operations, but also for other operations. But we need to relearn what has faded to some extent in our Navy, the ability to work as a system, to share the collective abilities of every platform that you operate, to be able to practice distributed lethality amongst your task group, and then to prepare yourself to operate with larger coalitions so you can provide even broader distributed lethality across those organisations.
Michael Fuller.
Thank you, Admiral, for a very interesting speech. Can I ask you, we have released today, I believe, a new paper on Russia's pivot to Asia, the other pivot, if you like. We know for a long time that Mr. Putin has talked about Russian interests in the Far East, and he's asserted that Russia is a player in our part of the world, not just in the European theatre. How much substance, from your observations, is there to the Russian pivot to Asia? Are they doing things differently from what we've come to see in the past? And in particular, perhaps you can talk about that very helpful visit by the Russian naval element during the G20 meeting last year. What did you make of that? Was that normal, or was somebody sending somebody else a signal? Thank you.
Let's start with the last part and move forward. Clearly, I think there was a message.
Clearly, that message from a purely naval perspective would be a demonstration that the Russian Navy can still deploy, can still sustain itself on deployment, and still has reach. I think whether it was intended or not, that was something that was clearly picked up by many. At the same time, I noticed that the ships that we had to meet those Russian ships in that part of the sea had come from both East Coast and West Coast. So we ourselves responded very quickly in a significant number just to welcome them to the region. But I think it shows an intent that that Russia has in being able to reinvigorate its position in the world using its naval forces predominantly at further distances from the homeland. But it's also complemented these days by flights of aircraft, in some cases Soviet-aged and Soviet-styled aircraft, through some of the routes that they previously flew in the Soviet era. I think there's a clear demonstration that the Soviets of the past still have a view amongst those in Russia that would indicate that Russia still has a position in the world that they would seek to re-establish. I think from our own perspective, we will see more engagement with the Russians in our part of the world. It might not be in the Coral Sea, but we might find ourselves as I indicated earlier, spend time in the South China Sea, as we have done and will continue to do. I think we may find ourselves passing more Russian ships than we would have in the past 10 years, and I imagine that will increase significantly.
Michael's question reminds me that I was lucky enough to be here for the fleet review in 2013 when there was supposed to be a Russian contingent that didn't show up. So perhaps the alternative interpretation is that they just came a little bit late.
I believe at the time they had other engagements that whilst they started towards this, they had other things to do. Yes.
Question in the front here.
Hi, Admiral. I just have a question about the HMS.
Could you identify yourself?
Sorry?
Could you say who you are?
My name's William. I'm from the University of New South Wales, the one that you went to. I just have a question about the HMAS Sydney that was stationed in the port of Yokosuka. It was mentioned by Malcolm Fraser in his book, 2014, Dangerous Allies. What is your interpretation of its being there? I mean, are you a believer of the fact that the Anglosphere can, you know, remain a dominating influence in this world? And should we question the HMAS Sydney's presence in that area? I mean, shouldn't it, like, is it better to have it protect our own interests, you know, to patrol our own waters instead of stationing there with the USS Washington strike carrier fleet? I hope that makes sense.
You're referring to the time where one of our ships was engaged with a US carrier battle group while it was conducting operations.
If it was necessary by the US, then that would be our Australian, you know, initiative.
Okay. It's a broad question around, I think, and I touched on it during my presentation here, around how we consider ourselves in the world. We are a global navy. We are a nation that seeks to send its navy global because we need to demonstrate as a nation that we have a right to be a proponent for the rule of law throughout the world. At the same time, as an island nation, we do receive much of our goods, 90% by volume, 70% by value, via the ocean. And so it's appropriate that we would move beyond our home waters to actually enact the fact that we have an ability and a desire and, if necessary, an obligation to defend our shipping routes should that be required. In the process of doing that, as I mentioned in my presentation, we would not seek to do that solely ourselves because, as a small navy, a relatively small navy, with a vast area to be able to manage from where our trade emanates, we'd seek to do that with others in partnership, our major alliance with the US. It would be appropriate for us to train regularly with the US to ensure that when we are taking those steps, that we would be able to work together. But we also engage and train with other partners in the region. And I mentioned we train. We've been to China recently. We train with the Singaporeans, the Malaysians, the Indonesians, and others. The issue is about demonstrating the rule of law at sea, the law of the sea itself, and our role in being able to provide security for those items that pass legally upon their ways when they're reaching us. You would have seen in the news recently, we've had a ship in the Gulf since well before 1991, but we're on our 60th rotation of ships in that area. It's on an anti-piracy and anti-drug interdiction role at the moment and has been very successful in that area. You would argue that it's thousands of miles away from where we are, but its role as part of a coalition working with others to be able to stop a trade that's affecting everyone within the world is important, and that's a demonstration from this government using our Navy to demonstrate that we have a view of a place in the world that demands that we take action where something is not as it should be.
Time is... I'm sorry, we have to cut that off. Time is limited. We have time for just one more brief question, please. I think I saw a hand raised at the rear of the room, sir.
I'll stand so you can see me. Ian Crawford, a retired sailor. Thank you, Admiral, for a very interesting presentation. You mentioned self-reliance, and this involves national logistics. And with our equipment, our ships, largely sourced from designs overseas, are you confident that with our declining manufacturing industry in this country, we have the capability to sustain our ships at the long line of interdependence?
Look, Ian, you're never a retired sailor. But once a sailor, always a sailor. Thank you for the question. It's most appropriate. I acknowledge the decline in some of the manufacturing industries around Australia, but I also acknowledge, from my perspective as the Chief of Navy, what is about to be an enormous change and requirement in a shipbuilding and sustainment industry within Australia, not just for the next 5 years or 10 years, but for the next 30, 50 or 100 years. I think the announcements by government around the recapitalisation of Navy will inherently provide an opportunity for industry and for the department in which I work, but also for other departments within government, be it education, be it industry, be it Treasury, to be involved in a recapitalisation of an industry that will provide me as the Chief of Navy warships, but at the same time will provide industry, the marine industry around Australia, be it offshore oil and gas, be it all those other users of state-owned vessels that operate on behalf of government, or even as a flow out from their commercial opportunities that may arise. I think I'm looking to a period of great opportunity here. What this government has provided is a level of certainty that we should commit to continuous shipbuilding. That is something that should be celebrated by industry, by Navy, by the person on the end of that phone, by anyone who is listening. So whilst I acknowledge that we have been through that, I think the opportunities are about to hit us. The important thing will be how we pick up those opportunities. To continue to do what we have done in the past in terms of shipbuilding is not the way to be able to produce an enduring shipbuilding organisation or industry. We need to change how we have prepared and managed ships in the past, not project by project, small numbers by small numbers. We're talking about a programmatic view across 50 to 100 years. If we take that approach, then we can create an industry that can both build and sustain here in Australia. And I am very optimistic that we are right at the cusp of being able to do that.
Thank you, Vice Admiral Barrett, for being so generous in terms of your time. As I said, we're very glad that you've picked the Institute for the location of your third lecture in this series, and personally have committed your time to be with us today. As you can see, it's a packed house, so I think there's no shortage of interest in the themes that you've laid out for us today. Can I just inform people that the next Lowy Institute event will in fact take place here tomorrow at 10:30, which will be a panel discussion led by Dr. Michael Fullilove, also with Anna Funder and Tom Switzer on the theme of a larger Australia. So the details are on our website, or you can ask a member of our staff on the way out. That's at 10:30 tomorrow. But most importantly, I would like to express our thanks from the Institute and can ask you please to show your appreciation in the usual way.
Thank you.
Very good.